Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 54 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I had a chat with Joe Goodkin, a Chicago-based singer-songwriter with a classics degree. For decades, he has toured the U.S. performing his original one-person song interpretations of Homer's Odyssey and Iliad called The Blues of Achilles. He has accumulated almost 400 performances between the two pieces in 45 U.S. states and Europe. He has written about his experience of being a modern bard for online journals and websites like Eidolon and Antigone. His work has been supported by many notable organizations, including the Society for Classical Studies and the Classical Association of the Middle West and South, and as a part of the National Endowment for the Humanities Institute on teaching trauma through ancient texts. In this episode, we spoke about his innovative work in combining classical stories and music into his own show, which other ancient stories should be fun to adapt into live music, and about both the challenges and advantages of taking his show virtual during the pandemic. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy! Thanks so much for joining me. Glad to have you here. So I just want to sort of get the ball rolling and say, you know, how did you get into classics in the first place?
Yeah, I call myself generally like an accidental classicist, which I don't think is that uncommon. I got to college at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I thought I was going to be a psychology major. And my freshman year at Wisconsin, I took Ancient Greek 101 just sort of on a whim. I had always been fascinated with ancient Greek characters and words and things like that. And by the end of the semester, I realized I just had totally fallen in love with the language and took Ancient Greek 102 and classical myth and classical archaeology my second semester. And by the end of my first year, I realized I was sort of in the world that I was supposed to be in and finished out a classics degree, bachelor's degree in classics at Wisconsin-Madison. Not long after that, I took a lot of what I'd studied about the Odyssey, and I wrote this one-man musical version of it, a 24-song retelling that, in my head at least, was going to attempt to recreate some of the circumstances of an oral tradition or a bard performing in a room. And I wrote it almost just to see if I could, and it turned into something that over 20 years later, I'm still doing. I'm doing more, and one epic song cycle has turned into two with a piece on the Iliad. So it's every step of the way, it's just sort of been chasing these fascinating things I found in the field, which has done amazing things for me. Yeah.
Nice. I mean, that's pretty awesome. Did you know right away that you wanted to take a stab at this creative venture, or after you got the degree, did you kind of consider maybe doing something else that might be, to other people, considered a little more profitable?
Yeah. you know about how this world works very well. I considered going to grad school, which I don't know if is more profitable or not. And I did for a number of years work a regular day job at a law firm that I suppose something about my classics degree was attractive enough for them to hire me as a paralegal. But the music side for me and the music and classics intersection has really just been sort of a slow build towards it taking over my life. I never wrote it with the intention of it being a moneymaker or a career. And I've just sort of found that there's enough interest in it for it to keep going, for me to keep doing it, and for me to expand this little modern bard niche. So the biggest thing I did consider was going on in graduate school, just because I loved studying it. I loved the material. I loved the Greek language. I was really lucky at Wisconsin to get not only the language side, but heavy dose on the literature side and the comp lit side as well from a couple really great professors. So I had this sense of how the poem and the material, you know, both Homeric and all sorts of ancient material has inspired artists and creators since then and studied that. And I think it was just like, well, maybe I can take a stab at doing something along the lines of what these other folks have done with it. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, I think everyone who goes through a classics program at some point sort of considers a maybe possibly going on, just because I don't think anyone who, you know, cares enough to go all the way through with a classics degree would want to sit here and say, well, okay, the learning's done. You know, I don't think they're going to say, there's nothing left for me to learn. All right, I got what I came for. Bye. So I would say you did what many of us have considered doing, but obviously it's not always the best option. So I applaud you for figuring out, you know, okay, well, maybe I won't do that and I'll go try something else. And yeah. So when you decided you were going to take on this cool modern bard venture, yeah. You know, did you know you wanted to try to sing it? Do you play an instrument? You know, I know that instrumentation is a big part of the ancient world as well. Yeah. So there's so many different ways musically and just creatively you could have gone. So tell me a bit about how that developed.
Yeah, sure. I guess what's interesting to look back on it now, because now I've written this first piece, The Odyssey, over 20 years ago, which is crazy. So at the time, I definitely thought about a lot of different ways to put it across. I thought, do I want to do like a recitation where I'm recreating, you know, something in the original language or certain aspects of the original language? And that part, of course, interests me because it's fascinating to think about. But I think I got the sense that, you know, there's so much speculation around that and so little evidence that it wasn't. And also, if I did that from a modern audience, it would be almost just like recreating an artifact. You know, it wasn't, I was really interested in trying to make the poems come back to life as performances that were shared in rooms with people. You know, that was the interesting aspect of it to me. And I guess I sort of went through the calculus in my head of, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to need to do some sort of sleight of hand and try to figure out like what parallel experiences I can create in modern times that might mirror what was going on in ancient times. And of course, like everything else we do, right? A lot of it's guesswork / defense of your thesis on this. So I think in some sense, I was lucky in that I was young and sort of like, I didn't know this would turn into a career. I wasn't doing it for like an academic reason or a money reason or anything. I just thought it would be really neat if I can do this. And like, what do I want my audience to get out of this? What do I think is valuable that maybe I've learned intellectually that I can sort of sneak into a performance and turn the modern audience onto, try to get them past some of the hurdles that sometimes the poems have for modern audiences. So I play the guitar and I'm a singer-songwriter, and I immediately sort of saw these parallels between what a lot of singer-songwriters that we love do with the stringed instrument and these songs that create emotion in the audience, that tell people's stories, that tell people's narratives, that create empathy, that pass on information and narratives. And I thought, well, that's not that different. I mean, it is, but it's not. Like, it's the same picture of people in a room listening to one person with a stringed instrument sing a story. And the biggest decision I probably made creatively that was just more of an instinct was I wrote all these songs in first person as if I was the characters, the singer was the characters. So they're not narrative in the sense of here's a bunch of exposition that just is in song lyrics. They're more like inside what the characters are going through in the story. And I tried to generalize their experiences to honor like the ancient Greek side of it or the pre-ancient Greek side of it, but also try to tease out what I thought universal experiences might be for mothers and fathers and sons and identity and being on a journey and all these other things in the Odyssey. So I think it's, if you're creative and you have an academic background in the classics, you're kind of walking this constant line between balancing your classics brain and your creative brain. And like sometimes they're going to clash because your classics brain is going to say, well, I want this to be rigorously intellectually based and I want to be able to defend this as if it's my thesis. And your creative brain is saying, but that's not going to work for the audience, you know, and you have to sort of constantly be playing this game of which parts of that classic side brain to use and which part of the creative side brain, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And obviously we have such great source material from the ancient world. So that kind of speaks for itself. That's really all the inspiration you need.
Yeah.
But what modern influences did you use to sort of craft your show?
Yeah. So this is where like the fact that I had not only had sort of that I had a really broad based study of classics at Wisconsin, I think really helped me. I had one classics professor and also one comp lit professor that were really big on looking at not only the source material, but also reception at that point. And I think this is long enough ago because it's the late 90s that reception was sort of not as big as it is today. It was beginning, it was out there and people were doing it. They just weren't calling it that, I guess, maybe. In particular, this comp lit class, we studied the Odyssey, but then we studied other pieces of work that captured some of the themes of home and identity. So we read Ulysses by James Joyce. We read Omeros, a poem by Derek Walcott, which is really beautiful. We watched like some pretty weird movies. Like we watched Planet of the Apes. They were home all along. You know, what does it mean to be home, you know, to your identity? We watched Waterworld. So I had this kind of like high and low culture, all culture, I guess, experience of like, there are really no rules around this. Like there's so many different aspects you can use to tell your version of the story. And then I guess in real time, it was right as Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was coming out, which was a, you know, this on its face version of the Odyssey that incorporates sort of contemporary or almost contemporary music. And then also there was a beautiful staging of the Odyssey here in Chicago where I'm based that I saw right after I graduated by a really wonderful director named Mary Zimmerman, who does a lot of work around reinterpretation of classical source material. And it was a beautiful sort of like, it made you feel the story, you know, it really brought it alive. It was evocative and sort of impressionistic, and it just left you feeling, which I think is what I wanted out of my version the most. So those were, I mean, I could go on and on because I've sort of stayed, I guess, in contact with some of the other versions, but those were the ones at the time that really helped me see the range of ways I could approach the story.
That's awesome. That's super cool. And what prompted you to keep it like this live performance? Like, I know that it is very evocative when it's live, but I mean, in thinking about kind of how interconnected digitally we are, you know, did you ever consider, you know, filming it or recording it so you could release it as
a DVD or something? Yeah.
Yeah. Just something. Was it like a deliberate choice, I guess, just to keep it live?
That is an amazing question. It was, and it was sort of a stubborn choice. First of all, but it's kind of a boring visual performance. Like part of what I committed to was this idea of no bells, no whistles. You're going to sit still for 35 minutes and listen to this. And we're not, you know, we're so used to supplemented media, you know, like, and that was true even, you know, 20 years ago, and it's even more true now. I was really stubborn and I said, you know, we're all going to turn our phones off or whatever, and nobody's going to film this. And I even went so far as to like ask people to take stuff down off the internet. Like I was really committed to there not being any document of it visually. I have an audio recording of it that I did about 10 years into it. I was decided to permit for audio, but I was really fascinated with this idea that in our culture, we basically have a way to preview almost everything. There's samples of stuff everywhere. And I wanted audiences to walk into it not knowing what it was going to be, the experience was going to be. I've softened on that. a bunch. There's a streamed version of it that I actually did at the American School in Athens last fall. That's like a full performance on YouTube that they did with some really nice, subtle, but really thoughtful production on it. So at some point I started letting go of that a little bit. And also like once the pandemic hit, I started doing that piece and my Blues of Achilles piece over Zoom quite a bit. And I allowed for recording and sort of archiving on that. So like everything else around it, it was this learning process of how I wanted it to live in the world. And I had some hard-fought intellectual ideas about how rigorous I was going to be. And after a couple hundred performances or more, I decided to relax those a little bit and let it be a breathing tradition. You know, it's okay if it changes. And that's part of the idea of performance, right? You know, you should let go of some of those stubborn things. Every performance is going to be different no matter what. So yeah, great question.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I think it's cool, and it does sort of get people still like into a theater, into a space.
Yep.
It's encouraging them, like, yes, we live in such a world where you can have everything kind of put right in front of you at home on your laptop. So to actually force people to get out and see something, I think is really great when I do believe that a lot of people don't recognize or necessarily see that as kind of being a thing these days. So
it's interesting because I think that generates a real visceral reaction. And when I started out doing this piece, it was largely for high school, like freshman English classes that were reading it. And talk about surprising an audience, like for a younger person to like walk in and start to just sing it at a group of 14-year-olds for 35 or 40 minutes, often without any amplification whatsoever. Like people still don't experience music like that that much anymore. Most of even acoustic music, if you see it live, is usually there's an intermediary of the sound system. And I try, the other thing I committed to early on was I tried my best to perform without amplification wherever the space and the audience allowed it, because there's something different about how the direct human voice accesses people's brains and emotions, even without anything between it, without any microphone or PA or reverb or whatever else you're going to put on something. So I definitely experienced what you're talking about. It's like, well, this is different. Like, we don't do this very often, you know?
Yeah, I was trying to think about the last time I went out to even see, not even just like a piece of theater, but music or anything that I couldn't just sort of, you know, pull up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Or anywhere else on the net. And, you know, I think the last time I really made myself see beyond like a concert of a you know, super
yeah, right.
popular artist or something. I grew up and my parents are still in Chicago.
Oh, nice.
So having Ravinia where it is like a super, every year, every summer during their summer like concert series, when the CSO, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, for those who don't know Chicago, when they go up to perform, they would always do at least one or two popular films and play the score live with the movie. And my father and I went to see all three Lord of the Rings, three different summers, and then they also did a series of concerts of Titanic, and then they did Gladiator or something like that. So it was pretty rad. I got to see all these really cool productions, and I'm really glad that I did get to see them, because yes, I can see them when I watch the films. There's something inherently special about seeing them played live with the film on a big screen, and you just can't replace that. And so I totally understand you wanting to have people feel that way when seeing your show. So total props to you for holding out as long as you did, for wanting people to really experience it live. When you knew you were going to do this and you knew that it was going to be musical, you know, did it cross your mind at any point that not only is it just kind of a cool, innovative thing because not a lot of people go with this medium, but did it cross your mind that also, like, I think that musical theater is the closest thing we have, period, to any kind of ancient world productions. Like, what we're doing with modern musical theater is basically what the ancient Greeks had. And so, to me, it's the closest form of artistic reception. So, was that like also a consideration that went in? Because not only was sort of a traditional bard retelling just kind of what they had, but even when, you know, what they did expanded from just one man, you know, did that factor into the thinking?
I guess like the intellectual side of me in the time in which the poems were initially created, all there was the experience, right? There was no artifact. It was free literacy, or at least the development of it. So even when we have these forms of documentation, if you're dealing with like lab performance, like you're talking about in a space with people, there is a thing that is only created when you're there with those people taking in whatever's coming in you, and that's gone. That's an experience that's not documented. So I was intellectually attracted to that. I was sort of like romantically attracted to how that was paralleling this pre-literate culture. And that's exactly the type of thing I was thinking of, is what you described there, for sure.
I'm very curious, well, one, to see, experience, hear the show, because I hadn't heard of it before. So I'm very excited to see it now. But also the experience I do have with sort of a one man, one woman, one person show. Way at some point in college, and I went to the University of Missouri, we had a very small but dedicated classics department. And coming to our school was a wonderful woman who put on a one woman performance of Clytemnestra, and I still have like a poster of it somewhere in my house, buried in all my things. Yeah, she was amazing. I thought to myself, it was really amazing. There wasn't music in it. It was a stage play. But I wonder, and I'm very curious, if something like your show, your music, would be able to sort of partner with a show like hers. And I wonder how magical it could be, you know, putting them together. So kind of with that in mind, you know, like, have you ever thought about maybe partnering with someone who would tackle a different aspect of, you know, the performance and seeing what you might be able to create?
It did a little bit. And actually, I think one of the reasons I was attracted directly to just the Homeric poems as source material and not something like the tragedies or the comedies was, I think, introducing that next performance sphere, whatever you want to call it, and multiple voices and staging, you know, that was almost something, it's not a judgment, but it's a step in a different direction. You know, the epic poem is ostensibly one person singing or reciting, chanting, singing. I will say that I'm in the process right now of adapting my second epic cycle, The Blues of Achilles, for stage in a much more conventional type of music theater setting. And I think that I'm sort of going through the process almost of how does epic turn into tragedy, for instance. And I'm sort of doing it as a creator in real time. Like, I wrote this set of songs that I saw as an epic performance, and now I'm having to transform them into something that's more like a tragic, or like, to your point, like a, it's a staged performance. It's much closer to this tragedy or ancient Greek theater. So I think I thought about, when I chose my source material, I just knew, like, I want to be one person in this. And I feel like the thing, the type, the genre I can do is epic, because it was one person with a stringed instrument. And now that I'm stepping into theater, I'm seeing that those seeds change in real time. You know, that's something I also saw when I had to take these performances and turn them into Zoom performances was, you know, I was an artist and a creator going through a medium change. Just like the epics went from performance to text, I was going from live performance to Zoom performance, which is a different medium, you know, entirely. So I love seeing those like insights that I can get into ancient facets of ancient performance, or the development of ancient performance, that I feel like I can get as a performer in real time, that you don't learn just from reading, you learn from going through it and saying, whoa, like, what did I have to go through to do this? I'm not saying it's always one-to-one with some ancient thing, but that's very much how we think we figured out all, you know, how epic was an oral tradition. We looked at some people still doing it, you know, 80 years ago, and we looked for features that were similar between these performers and in the text. So I love when that stuff happens. That's magic, and it makes you feel connected to people a long time ago and a tradition, and it sort of makes you feel humble, and it, you know, all the things that I think when you're doing this material correctly and you're being honest with it and you're invested in it, you have these moments where you feel connected to it in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I would, if I were creative in the sort of musical or even just the creative space you need to be an actor or something, that would be both a fun challenge, but also, yeah, it would be terrifying because I'm like, wow, I would have to take, you know, this very well-loved material that everyone sort of has an idea in their mind, whether they think they do or they don't. So, you know, props to anyone who wants to take that on. Kind of along with that, like, so, okay, excluding, obviously, Iliad and Odyssey, is there another poem or tragedy, comedy, any sort of ancient work that you would love to either take on yourself or see adapted so that you could maybe work with someone on it? So maybe you don't have to do all of it yourself, but.
Yeah, I think that's what may wind up happening with this stage version of the Iliad, of the Blues of Achilles, is it's exactly what you're talking about, where it's incorporating tools from us, putting the music alongside another performance strain, you know, and taking more of the conventional character-driven theater stuff and using the music as an enhancer or a partner or a, you know, a dialogue, basically. The Odyssey is entirely sung, and it's sung straight through 35 minutes without stopping. And I thought that was important because of the journey aspect of it. I wanted the audience to go along for this ride that was physically demanding on me as a performer. And it was just like, you see somebody sing for 35 minutes straight, essentially, you know. The Blues of Achilles, which is the Iliad retelling, I treat it much more like a kind of like your standard singer-songwriter set, where I introduce each song and there's some talking in between. And it's not like you're talking about, which is an actor becoming a character, but there's more narrative and references to characters. So I think, I'm sure that performance was amazing. And I've certainly seen some receptions that are in that. I did try to do a very early on theater piece with the Odyssey songs, and it just didn't seem like it worked. And that's could be because I didn't write the songs with that in mind. It could be because we just didn't get it right. And I've always tried to be comfortable with it just being this musical piece. And for, you know, like my standard line to like audiences who have differing opinions about how I should do it is, well, you do a version then. Like this is what like myth is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a collection of all these different versions, none of which have more or less value than the other ones, but all of which form the myth. Like it's not, you know, we don't have definitive versions. We like definitive versions as modern people, but we didn't, right? We allow for this flexibility and we allow each performer or each creator to bring out, like you said, you know, different strands of the story, different aspects. So it's a tough line to watch, you know, because you want your thing to do everything that the source material does for you. But like, how are you going to take a 15,000 or a 12,000 line poem, you know, that was created over centuries and do all of it in an hour, let alone, what is it, the line of the anxiety of influence or something like that, where you're like constantly intimidated but inspired by your source material? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I see all the advantages. I love the idea. I love that someone suggested Gilgamesh. I think,
right,
especially since it's one of the epics that's not as widely known because, well, for obvious reasons, people just don't like to focus on the ancient Near East the way we do on the classical world. Sitting here as one who has not actually seen your adaptation of the Odyssey, so I can't say for sure, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say, one, it's fabulous, and two, I'm also going to just go out on a limb and assume that a creative with your talents would be probably someone I'd love to see work on the Aeneid.
Yeah, it's funny because I wrote the Odyssey piece in 2001 and 2002, and I didn't write this Iliad piece until 2018 and 19. Like I was really, this is another thing I was stubborn about. I was like, I'm only going to do this one thing this way. It's going to be its own thing. And really it was just that I accessed the Odyssey a lot easier, and whether that was just because I studied it more or it's a more sort of doors to get in as a modern person, I was sort of terrified of taking on the Iliad because it's a heavy, heavy story. And there were aspects of it that I did not feel comfortable trying to portray or characters I didn't feel comfortable speaking for until I did a lot of work thinking and reading and talking to people in the military world, for instance. Now, though, I am trying to stay sort of like one step ahead. The two stories that have sort of caught my, you know, brain and hung around in the back, I really love Philoctetes, the Sophocles play. I think that's just a, I don't know what I would do with that, but I it really strikes me that some of the way I write music and some of the things I think about and some of the things I found important in the Iliad are also maybe in a way connected there. And I know that's a piece that people have done to really great effect in various modern situations. And then also, and this is maybe goes to your point about collaboration, I had somebody come up to me at a performance in a lot within the last year and say, have you ever thought about doing something similar with the Epic of Gilgamesh? And it was a professor of Near Eastern studies. And I thought, well, that's really interesting for a lot of reasons. Clearly, that has aspects of both the texts that I've taken on. So I asked her for here's the Epic of Gilgamesh right here. That's something that, you know, I started reading about a little bit and just thought, I'm just going to plant that seed. I know I have some people that could help me out with parts of it because it's not something I studied nearly in the depth that I did the Iliad and the Odyssey. I feel like one of the things I've learned about being inspired by classical source material is sometimes you have to wait for it, for yourself to catch up to it or for it to be the right time. One of the other amazing things about the text is they mean different things to you at different points in your life. And you sort of have to wait till you get to the part in your life when you're inspired by a particular text, if you keep your ears and your mind and your heart open. But collaboration, what I've been doing with adapting this piece for stage, I've done a lot of collaboration already with this. I've worked with a playwright and another playwright and some actors in workshopping it. And it's been really excellent. Like, I think if you find yourself in the right collaboration with people, especially if you've been working on your own with this stuff for decades, it's really invigorating and it can actually be a lot easier if you get along with the people because you don't have to do it all yourself. So yeah, that's the one. See, that's the obvious one, right? Like, and the resistance I have to that, to me, parallels kind of the resistance I had to the Iliad for years. So I'm not, the piece of Latin literature I thought I might suit me better would be the Metamorphoses, just because that to me is already sort of a collection of songs about things. The Aeneid was my favorite Latin I've ever read in undergrad, and I was never as good at Latin as I was at Greek, but the Aeneid I thought was an incredible work. So I wouldn't rule any of it out. You know, it occurs to me the other idea I had was to maybe write a cycle of songs about one of the lost epic poems, you know, one of the lost that we don't have, one of the three or four, or to make up an epic cycle and then write a, you know, like to do something. Actually, that was one of my partnership ideas, was maybe ask a poet to write one of the lost epic poems and then do a song cycle off of that, you know, really try to take it one step back in the life cycle and experiment with that. So it takes a long time is the problem. As you know.
Yeah, I can see things taking a very long time. I mean, it took me such a long time to get my own button gear to do a lot of projects that I wanted to. So, you know, I mean, I think it'll be I can see, obviously, why you wouldn't want to take on something as big and as challenging as the Aeneid, and the fact that it is very similar to Homer's epics.
Yeah.
In certain regards. Yeah. You know, as you were talking, though, it got me thinking, I would actually love to see you take on one of my favorite tragedies, which is Euripides' Trojan Women.
Sure.
Because I think what I've been doing is I've been reading recently a lot of different adaptations of the Iliad, novelizations and other things.
What have you read? You know.
Let's see. I read Song of Achilles. Mm-hmm. And I just finished Pat Barker's Silence of the Girls, which was good.
Excellent book, yeah.
I'm going to be reading a few other adaptations. I think we've got Women of Troy. Yep. And, you know, I've read Natalie Haynes' A Thousand Ships. Just my favorite out of all of those. So, you know.
That's her sequel to the Silence of the Girls, right? Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I love everything she does. Anything Natalie Haynes does, I'm such a stan.
That's really well done. You've heard her 20-minute versions of Iliad and the Odyssey?
Yeah,
she's amazing. That Iliad thing had me on the floor. I think it's book 18 where she's like, Menelaus finally does something right. And that's the entire
I mean, everything she does is amazing. So yeah,
I agree.
But hearing all these different, reading all these different adaptations now, I mean, obviously they're so different and that's all between different books. But there's something just so harrowing about their story that I think would lend really well to a musical adaptation. I mean, you know, you hear of ancient Greek laments when heroes die, people die, but, you know, you kind of, you're like, oh, okay, a lament, cool. But I think there'd be something so visceral about hearing these tragic women's fates unfold. So that I know would be very ambitious, but I think sort of musical adaptation.
I agree. And it's funny you brought that up because one of the songs I'm working on for this stage version of the Iliad of the Blues of Achilles just today is sort of based on what the Trojan women do in book 22 when they learn when Hector's died and Andromache comes out on the wall and they're all lamenting, to your point, wailing, you know, for Hector, but also for the city. Like, they know the city's going to fall at that point, right? I mean, he's the city. And I was just reading that passage, thinking about exactly what you're talking about, you know, this oral, A-U-R, you know, A-L quality of what this mourning must have sounded like, you know. Same thing in book 18 of the Iliad, with when Achilles learns Patroclus is dead and Thetis comes up with all her nymphs and they're all wailing, and all the women, you know, all the women they've taken as prisoners are wailing. And you just think, like, it must have just been the most intense, heavy sounds. I think that story is amazing, the play. And I love all the different receptions. I think that's actually something that students now and people now, there's so many more good, varied receptions of this material than there were when I was, like, I would have killed for all the receptions you just listed, and then there's a lot more than that too. You know, it's like, it's easy to lament sort of how the classical discipline is the trouble it's going through, like a lot of other academic disciplines, but this reception piece, and I don't mean this disparagingly, like in popular culture, just accessible culture, is really vibrant. And I think it's a sign that the material is reaching people in different channels, and it's not something I'd had when I was an undergrad. There was not these versions that you just listed that are really clearly exciting people, you know, and it's very cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was just thinking, you know, of all the different ways that we do encounter reception, it flashed me back to when I was pretty young. I think I was in high school or something, but my dad, when I was growing up, he was kind of a theater critic, so he would go and he raised me and my sisters on Shakespeare, so we were like the Shakespeare nerd family, and so we would always get tickets to see plays at the Shakespeare Theater on Navy Pier. And my dad, I remember he came to me and just said, hey, I know you're really big into just, you know, the different versions of these sort of classic pieces of art. So he sort of had to work on me and pitch me the idea of going. And I said, okay, Dad, just tell me, what is it? And he said, well, it's Othello, but it is not traditional at all. And I was like, okay, well, how untraditional could you make Othello? Right. I mean, it's kind of... And he said, well, it's a rap Othello play. And I said, wait, what? No, what? And he was like, yeah, he said it's like a rappy, hip-hoppy Othello. And I said, well, is it like traditional but told in rap? And he said, no, I mean, he's like, the whole thing is rap. So all the costumes are very contemporary. There's going to be a lot of sort of neon staging and the sort of ripped jeans, the gold chains and the backward caps. And I was like, what on earth are people thinking? So I went to it. Yeah. And it was fabulous. I just really had a different expectation, but I ended up loving it. It was weird, but it was good weird in the good way.
See, well, and it's such a great window into how elastic even what we think of as being fixed texts are, right? It, you know, like we saw a version of Hamlet out on Navy Pier at Shakespeare Theater. It must have been just not long pre-pandemic, where they didn't do like the last act, or I can't remember how they edited it, but it was a take on Hamlet that was more about his grief and less about the politics around the story. So they cut out some of the stuff at the end that's about the politics, and it's like, wait, you can do that? Like, you can just end it early? Like, and yeah, of course, like, your job as an interpreter is to take a perspective, you know. So I think that's what we get with all these reception versions too, is that you have a freedom, and nobody owns it. You know, nobody owns it. It's meant to inspire people. It's meant to be fluid. It's meant to for people to feel something about it. Like, do something that people don't like to, like you said earlier, you know, people have very strong opinions about these works, and in their head, they have this picture of these characters and what they do and how they feel and what they look like. And if you do something that doesn't, you know, they're like, wait a minute, that's not, well, you know, I get that, but like, no, it's all of it. It's, I will say, like, when I went to perform it in Greece, at the American School, that was a little bit like, well, all right, maybe these, this culture does, they get, I'm not going to go in and lecture about what I think the oral tradition is behind this, because this is not my place to do that. But they loved it though. The audience loved it. You know, the people who were Greek who were there seemed to really dig what I was doing with it. And it was, it can absorb this stuff. You know, it can take it. It can take it. We don't have to worry about offending it, you know?
For sure. Although I'm curious, is that a consideration at all when you take on such well-known, much beloved, and again, material that people get very, very passionate about? You know, is that kind of a worry sometimes, where do you have to factor in, okay, like, yes, you have creative license to kind of take things and do whatever, but also because it's probably the most traditional of all the things that people are expecting.
Sure.
You know, is there a fear that, okay, well, I can take it here, but maybe I don't want to take it all the way out here, because then people just won't like it, because they're expecting the unexpected, but maybe not like this unexpected.
It's a step too far. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a line you walk. It can be used to great effect, like you said, and then it can be used to such effect that it winds up alienating an audience. And also, I mean, you even have to take into account that if you play it for 100 people, what if 85 people dig it and 15 don't? You know, like, what's the, you know, is that a success? Is it a failure? Is it, you know, the, like, I'd say the two experiences I have with that, with the Homeric poems, are my Odyssey version has very little of books 9 through 12, the monsters. It just did not fit the story I was telling. And it's the most well-known part of it. Everybody knows the monsters and the adventures and the Cyclops and the Siren. And I at best give that about 30 seconds for all four books, basically. And I do it in such a way that, to me, the way I wrote the lyrics stands in for what those four books are doing for the character of Odysseus. And it helps the audience understand what that part of the journey meant to him and his character. But audiences sometimes don't like that. They don't, they say, where were these? I say, they're in Homer's version, and this is, you know, this is my version. It's interestingly, I don't portray Odysseus as like sympathetic, because I find him sympathetic. I just, in my portrayal of him as a human being, I think audiences tend to feel more sympathy than they want to sometimes. And they get angry at me for that. Or they will confront me about that. They'll say, well, you portrayed him like this, but really he's a schmuck. And I'm like, well, no, I just sang what I thought he would sing as a character. And if you believe it, that's on you. Like, you don't have to believe everything. And then the last piece where I feel like maybe I walk up to the line and maybe go over it a little bit, or it's a tricky line to navigate, is in the Iliad. You know, Achilles and Patroclus's relationship is clearly of interest to modern audiences, as it was for ancient audiences. You know, it's not like a new question of what their relationship was. We've been kicking around for 2.5 millennia. And I think that was something I thought really long and hard about, how I wanted to, because it's important to the story. First of all, clearly you need to be pretty clear for yourself on what you're representing. But you have to, I think, anticipate some of these points that the audiences are going to be particularly passionate or have fully formed judgments on. And I knew that, I think, is a consequence of a book like The Song of Achilles or The Silence of the Good. Like, there's more reception now around their relationship. So modern audiences have more to say about it, more to think and more to feel. And it's their connection to the story in a lot of ways. And that's, again, one of these moments where bards always adapted to their audiences. The oral tradition was always about, how are you going to get the audience to remember the story? And what do you need to drop in a little bit about their local hero to get them to remember it? Cool. We're going to do 10 lines about the local guy who killed a boar. Okay, great. Now we're back to the, you know, so I feel like that's like part of the job, is to anticipate the flashpoints and navigate them for the audience, you know?
For sure. And I'm curious as well, when you kind of go around and have to sort of introduce yourself to people and describe what it is that you do, Do you find that hard? Is it easy? And what is the reaction when you kind of tell people, well, you know, I'm kind of like a modern bard?
What's weird about it, yes, it's hard because it's, what's the elevator pitch of what I do? Like, you know, I got to tell you about what I try to do and this thing and this thing. Modern bard kind of just captures, like, people can connect to that pretty quickly. It's interesting enough. It's different from just singer-songwriter, but it's also not so, like, obtuse, you know, that you have to go through a lot of explanation. The thing that I found that's hard to describe to people who ask, that at first I was really self-conscious about, but I learned over time was really a strength, is I don't really belong to any one world. Like, I'm a musician, but what I do doesn't look like what people think of when they think of musician. It kind of does. Like, I go places and play music, but, you know, it's not in venues that most people think of. And the shows are in the afternoon sometimes. And, you know, I'm not really like a classicist in the conventional sense. Like, you know, writing and publishing is not my thing, although I've done some sort of writing in some of these great open source, you know, classics online journals that we have now that are, again, we did not have when I was in school. But it's not academic, you know, it's not peer reviewed. So, like, at first I was really apprehensive because I didn't feel like I felt fit in any one of the worlds. But then I realized, I was like, well, that's actually really cool because I'm not really competing with anybody. Like, there's not a lot of modern bards going around to colleges and universities and doing these things. And it's really, once I saw that, it really helped me be confident going to people who would get what I do, you know? So, like, when I'm pitching a college professor, I don't have to really explain much about the classic side, clearly. I might have to explain a little more about the music side, but it's turned into a much bigger piece of my life and my career than I ever thought it would, because I'm doing something different and it incorporates all these different fields. It incorporates the academic side, the creative side, the musical side. I get to talk about everything I love about the material and everything I love about music and everything I love about performing, I get to do. It's not an easy elevator pitch, but it turns out that not everything that's cool has to be an easy elevator pitch if you know your audience and you know the people who are going to help you bring it to your audience.
Nice. And okay, so I know you've come to Greece to perform.
Yeah.
You've done it around the US. By all standards, I could look at it and say, oh, this is super successful. It's gone global. That's what success looks like to me. What does success look like to you? Like, you know, if you could bring your show anywhere, where would you want to bring it?
That is a great question. It's been an evolving definition of success that, like, I think is pretty typical for a lot of people, where you're like, once I do this, I'll be successful. And then you do that and you're like, wait, oh, there's six more things over there. But no, I'm really proud of where it's gone. You know, you did a really nice little, done it in Greece and Rome and internationally. And I've done it, that piece, 350 times in the US and 44 states. And I have this new piece, you know, like I said, the Blues of Achilles, that seems to really be taking off, that I'm getting asked back to all the places I did the Odyssey to do this piece, which is really, that's a real definition, I think, of success, is when people say that was really good last time, you know, come back and do your other thing. I have sort of a weird definition of success, which I'm trying to play the Odyssey in all 50 US states. And that is more just like an interesting goal to me that I think is less about validation and more just like a cool hook and a cool way to measure how far I can take it in the US. So I only have six more states to go, which is cool. I still love doing it. Like, I just love the baseline of performing both of these pieces. And I still think I can get better at them. I mean, even hundreds of performances in, I wrote them, well, the Odyssey I wrote, you know, 20 plus years ago, like, I was a different person. So my own work means something different to me now than when I wrote it. It's like, I don't even feel like I wrote it. I feel like I'm just doing a thing and I'm interacting with the story differently and I'm interacting with the music differently. And it's really kind of a remarkable place to be as a creative person. You know, it's like there's a freedom and a way it's informing me and I'm informing it in an interaction that's really, I'm going to keep doing it till that stops. Like, as long as people will listen. I mean, I would be lying if I said I didn't want to take this stage adaptation as far as Hadestown went. No, I'd love for it. I'm really excited about it because I feel like it takes everything I put into the music and what you brought up earlier, it adds other storytelling tools and audiences can get everything I hope they get out of the music part and then maybe when they can see characters on stage doing it, like a little bit more, we're bringing a little bit more of it to them. So I hope that gets put on and does well. And then, I hope I find another piece to be inspired by in the same way so I can make something else. It was really interesting going through the pandemic because I was another way in which I'm not a conventional musician. Most of my friends who are conventional musicians had really, really tough times in the pandemic because all the gigs went away. And, I worked a ton doing virtual shows for especially the first year when everything was online, because what I do and the way I interact with an audience around discussion, and it worked really well on Zoom. It wasn't my favorite thing to do, but it was, professors were interested in anything to mix up, their Zoom lectures. And it was also really cost efficient. I could just beam in from right here, and they didn't have to pay for travel, and I could still, everybody wins. My career is good, and students get to experience something. And there were people, Zooming in who were all around the world. That's probably my biggest audiences were Zoom audiences in some ways. So I'm also interested in how I can adapt it based on reality. Like what's happening next, that'll change what I do, that I can morph this raw material, this emotional material into different storytelling.
I think that's really excellent. I think that's really cool. I know success is obviously measured differently by everyone. So good job. That was a really tough question because, if I ask that to 10 people, I'll get 10 different answers. So
Yeah.
I think that's really awesome. I think being able to say, yeah, that you've shown a show in 50 states would be a really cool benchmark to hit. So
Yeah.
I absolutely hope that you hit that goal. I believe that you will because, I mean, we're living in an age where there's such an interest in classical material. So I'm sure people in those
Yeah.
last 6 states are going to be like, yes, you know what? If it's classical, bring it. We'll.
That we're getting there. I've actually performed a bunch in Columbia, Missouri,
Really?
at Mizzou, because the Missouri Scholars Academy at all? Do you know of that? So I've played like there like 6 years, 6 different years, including just this last June. You must know, Ted Tarko?
Yes, of course. He was my dean.
Yeah. So he started bringing me out there in like 2014 in the summers. Yeah. So I love Columbia. I've really grown to, it's probably outside of Chicago, maybe the place I've played almost the most outside of Chicago, close to it, because I've been there 6 or 7 times. Yeah.
Wow, that's
Pretty neat.
pretty neat.
Pretty neat. Yeah, definitely.
Wow, I'm a little mad though, because that would have intersected when I was a student down there, so.
It was always like June or July. It was always in the summer. And then
Okay.
there were a couple years that there's 1 year I didn't, and it was just a buzz in and buzz out, like one performance and then play for those high school sophomore juniors, whatever they were, and leave. But I've being able to go back and do it this year after 2 years away, it was really cool. Like it was, I have a lot of fond memories. And that's a great classics department too. A lot of the Homeric scholarship, that's a very important department for Homeric scholarship. So I have a couple professor friends who came through that department for their PhD, like Justin Arft, who do a lot of work around Homer to me. That's really interesting.
Oh man, it's bringing on the nostalgia because
It's
I haven't
a
been
great
down
Odyssey to learn
there. Yeah,
too.
I mean, I haven't been down there in several years now. Definitely since
Yeah.
before the pandemic. I was there for homecoming, I believe, in 2019, maybe. But yeah, well, and a lot of my professors actually, at least three or four of them have all retired.
Starts to
So
happen, right?
I'm a little sad because I really wish they were
Yeah.
still there, but I mean, they're still in Columbia, but
I mean, another wonderful thing is I've gotten to go back and play at Madison a couple times, a bunch of times. And my home department there has been really supportive, which is, that's a really special thing too. That's definitely a home of sorts, as I'm sure you feel about, Mizzou. And it's that was just this last spring. I got to go perform for the classical myth class at Madison. I got to perform the Blues of Achilles for the classical myth class, which was really like one of my most important classes, 20 plus years ago, almost 25 years ago. And that was a really cool moment of just like, this is the reason I'm here and I'm doing it for this class. And it wasn't my original professor because he's retired, but it was the professor that like inherited the class from him. It was the same class. I was like, Wow, you never know. You never know where this stuff leads, you know?
Wow, that would be the dream. One day, because I started out in a
Yeah.
big classical mythology class, and, you
Who
know.
didn't, right? Five, however many hundred people, and, you know,
Yeah.
it's like, it's,
Yeah, yeah. We went to universities with huge departments. I have plenty of friends who, you know, the idea of being in a classics course with like 400 people in one lecture is like ridiculous to them. They're like, "What do you mean 400 people?" I was like,
Yeah, right.
"What?"
It's gonna be seven people, right?
Yeah, they were like, you know, there's like not more than 20. And I'm like, well, my upper level classes, we had about between 20 and 30. But I was like, no, these big
Yeah.
ones, like 400. She was like,
Yeah.
oh my gosh, what are you talking about? That's crazy.
Well,
Yeah.
that's a and that those are some of the classes that have survived too, because they are really popular. And you know, I think they're very important to departments now.
I think they're the most important because that's what gets you the foot in the door. The other ones, I mean,
Yeah.
that's for
Yeah.
people who already like the stuff. So.
That's a You're singing my tune.
Exactly. So all I want to say is like I do know that I would love to see one the work you do have. I would love to see the future work that gets done. And obviously the material you're doing is quite different. So I would say, you know, it's not one of those traditional sort of, well, if it gets big, then it goes to Broadway and then millions of people see it. You're on a very different track. But what I can sort of envision, if you know, just from a casual observer, I would love to see your work picked up and enjoyed, like fans of Einar Selvik. Do you know him from Vårdruna? He's the lead singer from Vårdruna.
Okay, I will look that up.
Vårdruna, it's a Norwegian
Okay.
singing group, and they basically take old Norse myths and legends. And they
Sweet.
sing about them in the skaldic style. So
Nice.
if you've seen the or heard of the TV show Vikings, they did like half the
Yep.
soundtrack for that show.
Cool.
And
Yeah.
so Einar goes, travels, and oftentimes he'll go with the rest of the Vårdruna members, but oftentimes he'll just go tour alone and he'll sit and he'll
Yeah.
sing songs about old Norse myth and legend in the skaldic style. So to me, I'm
That's
kind of like,
beautiful.
that seems like the path that you're on. And so I hope
Yeah,
that
well.
it's I hope that your success mirrors his, 'cause he's kind of a big deal and I've wanted to see him in concert for a very long time and I don't know if I will, but I
Yeah.
do. So that's kind of what I'm
Excellent.
envisioning, so
I'm always appreciative of every audience, because I think doing that stuff is asking something of your audience. You know, like it's not kind of, this is, I guess, to loop back where we started the conversation. You know, you're putting a little bit of a demand on your audience, you know, to something that's a little different from what they're used to. And I appreciate, like, I don't have to fake appreciating audiences. Let's put it that way. I love anytime some people get in a room and they sit still and quiet for 30 or minutes or an hour and listen to me sing songs about Homer. I just think, like, wow, like that's a gift right there. Whether it's 10, 100, you know, 800, like whatever it is. I mean, that's like clearly this culture that of interest is the reason for the podcast, right? I mean, it's like it's really cool what you're doing with it, and like I keep saying, I wish I would have had stuff like this when I was in college, and I'm glad people do now, because it seems like it keeps the flame going and illuminates all the different ways people are inspired by the material.
You know, that's that it ties into my favorite thing, which is if people want to complain about not having things, I'm like, okay, well then create
Yeah.
it. And so I kind of love
That's
how
it.
that's what we're doing, right? Like we didn't have
That's it.
either of these things and we're like, you know what? It's fine. We'll create it. Boom.
That's exactly right. That's
So
exactly
I
right.
love that we're doing that. And I mean, so now we've been, you know, talking about how both of our work sort of centers on, you know, capturing the essence and looking at and analyzing and appreciating and loving these sort of timeless, amazing ancient texts and everything else. So I want to sort of pivot us toward another timeless text, or I think it's a timeless text, is Shelley's Ozymandias poem. So at the end of every podcast, I have each guest read it. And as soon as you've read it, if you could just, you know, tell us your thoughts on it. You know, I think it's a great poem. A lot of other people hopefully do too. You know, why do you think it is or isn't a great poem? You know, what sticks out about it to you, basically?
Cool. All right. I'll read it first, right? All right. Let's do it. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor, well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains."
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level stands stretch far away. Well, that's intimidating. That is so beautiful. I mean, it's funny because I've read it, but I've never had to do a dramatic reading of it. And I've never thought about it in the context, you know. I like the line and the thing that resonates the most with me. Tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. And I guess I like it because of my standing as a sculptor or a creator. And I'm of two minds about whether the author matters. The sort of postmodernist in me says the author doesn't matter at all. But then the creator in me still nags. Like, it's kind of nice when somebody notices that the sculptor, you know, well read the passions. So I think that's a really that, you know, my heart jumps a little bit when I read that. I think it's really beautiful. Is that enough?
Yeah, I mean, hey, it's as much or as little as you want to say about it, because
yeah,
you know, it's really yeah. hard, and obviously everyone interpret poetry differently, so you know, there's no
yeah.
right or wrong. There's just reading it and then
yeah.
just
yeah.
absorbing what it is that we've read. But what I will say is that when I read this, it is a very political statement by Shelley. It's a treatise in 14 lines on the ephemeral nature of political power, where he's like, you know, it's like a memento mori, right? A reminder that you will die.
Yeah.
This poem, you can analyze it in so many different ways. And I'm pretty sure I've analyzed it in every single way you could, and still there's always new things. But yeah,
very
it's
cool.
just, it's a, kind of an argument about monumentality and, you know, what will remain, how do things remain permanent versus impermanent? Do you do it yourself? Do you need help? Even if you have all the help in the world, is it going to remain? I mean, thinking about it, you know, it's about this king. It's about Ramses II. And obviously at the time he thought his civilization was going to last forever and it was going to be the pinnacle of the world. And well, it was kind of buried by sand, and then other things happened. So, you know, it could be read in so many different ways. So kind of thinking about it like that, though, the last question I sort of ask every guest is just think for a minute about our contemporary society right now. Is there like a modern version of Ozymandias? Do we have a modern Ozymandias? Something that's so great and amazing, but realistically, you know, are future humans going to look back and be like, yes, I have the same opinion, or no, that's terrible?
That is a great question, especially when we're dealing with, you know, what epic poetry was meant to preserve. My brain says that we're going to remember the Beatles. And I know that's a slightly different, you know, a different agenda than that poem. And but it's a really good question. You know, first of all, the practical considerations of how stuff lasts. You know, how does it actually make it to each successive generation or way beyond? And is it the most important stuff that always makes it, or is it just the stuff that people, like to your point, had an agenda around and wanted to make it? I don't know. I'm not going to predict the future, but I'll say I hope it's my version of the Odyssey and the Iliad. How about that? That makes it.
Hey, that works just fine. You know,
very selfish, you know, but no, I mean, I guess part of what attracts me to just to put a button on it, I know there's a lot of political considerations around how the Odyssey and the Iliad were transmitted. But I do think the creative spark and the seed of it is hundreds of years of thousands of people performing this thing. And I find that, you know, this real folk tradition, and I find that really moving, because it's not this auteur thing, you know, of somebody made a monument or whatever. It's humanity, you know, humanity made this, and there's no such thing as something that's perfect, but it bears a lot of the marks of a group, humanity, you know, not, so maybe there's something like that we have that, I don't know if we do. Maybe it's something we can't even anticipate, you know, now that's going to last. But what a great question. Now my head's going to explode all day. So
yeah, it's a big one. So, I mean, we can, well, first I'll say thank you again for joining me. It was so fun to get to know you, to talk to you a bit. And you know, where can people find you just to follow your work?
Yeah, the two best places for my classics work are joesodyssey.com and thebluesofachilles.com. And then I also have a website, joegoodkin.com, joegoodkin. And that's just a hub for, I also make non-classically inspired music, kind of more conventional singer-songwriter stuff. So those three places, and then any of my social media accounts, just at joegoodkin. I post a lot about classics. I post a lot about the development of these pieces and my journeys to perform them. And then there are recordings of both of these pieces up on the usual music services and Spotify and YouTube. And you can find me if you're looking for me. I also should say that just this fall, I have a vinyl LP recording of the Blues of Achilles that I just put out, or I'm putting out, I guess, on record, which you can order through my website too. People like physical things. And I recorded the Blues of Achilles analog directly to tape, and it's a really cool recording done here in Chicago that I'm really proud of. So yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, eventually when I get myself back home to Chicago, we'll have to do some sort of collaboration, because we love to spotlight people who do classical work.
Fantastic. Yeah, I like that we have the Chicago and the Columbia connection a little bit too. So. Thank you so much.
Cool. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.